Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's For Women. You are not 9 to 5 and neither are we. Conveniently open online 365 days per year, 24 hours per day.
Happy Eurovision weekend, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. Hello, Europe. Well, hello, Irish listeners who missed the show this week. You're welcome wherever you are. We have a selection of the best conversations of the past couple of days as a warm ear hug for you as enjoy a lovely weekend too. Oh, the sun is out there indeed. Now, we begin the podcast with the glorious Marion Keyes, best-selling author, all-round lovely person. We touched on everything with Marion. The new novel, which is already a hit in Ireland and the UK, bestseller. The Netflix series on grown-ups, which is coming out soon. She's going to tell us what a feathery stroker is, subspecies of males, and her milestones in life as well. Recovery from addiction 30 years ago. She recently turned 60. She's moving into a fancy Dan new house somewhere in Dublin. And how fizzy vitamin C drinks now come in much nicer flavours. She knows everything, and you cannot but love Marion Keyes. After that, we have a chat with Fiona Neary about her life growing up with foster siblings. She's written a very gentle memoir called Parcels in the Post. It's got arrows of truth in there. Her mum thrust the family into looking after kids in the west of Ireland, kids who needed a home, that is, in the care system. And her family home was that place. It's really interesting because it's the rare perspective of a birth child, who was Fiona, growing up as the foster children came in and out of her parents' home and their family home. Babies, teenagers, all ages really. Very curious vantage point that you don't hear from too often or ever really. And then, the end of the podcast, it's visiting critic time. Who was it this week? Jarlath Regan, comedian, runner, man with a very strong hairline. Would you believe what was out of his comfort zone for critiquing this week? Quite surprising. Science fiction. Because I thought all comedians were dorks. So he dived in late to the Star Wars multiverse stuff. He watched Rogue One. He loved it. And somehow he found that Rogue One, the Star Wars movie from 2016, is about Dermot Bannon and the Death Star. So you have to stay listening to that to find out what the hell I'm talking about. So enjoy the offerings here. Thank you very much for listening. Subscribe to the show on your app, whatever you're using for your podcast. And thanks for all your support and your messages. Listen out to us on the wireless, RT Radio 1 from 9 a.m. till 10, Monday to Friday. And we're going to have a musical flourish now, and then we're going to go right into the podcast. Happy weekend. Good morning, Marion Keyes.
Good morning, Oliver.
Are you
Callan.
Okay now? Are you comfortable and everything?
I am.
And you know, you've no tea or
I have water, thank you.
I hope someone offered.
They did, of course. Okay. They did indeed.
That's actually something we could even know about you, the fact that you turned down the tea or coffee.
I have one cup of coffee in the morning and that's
so it's
it.
It's done now.
Yeah, because it's not for health reasons or anything. It just makes me feel a bit sick. And and then I can't sleep.
It's a health reason, isn't it?
Yeah.
How do you take your coffee then in the morning, would you?
A little bit of milk.
A little bit of milk. Oh, so you have a black coffee with a little touch of milk into it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Do you mean like you have a fancy coffee? No.
Okay. But that's you for the day.
Yeah, I'm
kind of similar. I get a bit dizzy, actually.
Yeah, it's not good for me, really. It makes me feel, like if it made me feel nice, I'd have loads of them.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, that is very much my brand.
That's a good point. Come here to me. How are you? Because you're a few weeks in now with the new book. How are you with the panto of interviews and the promotion and maybe explaining sometimes you have to do
no,
and
I'm
reviews?
I'm grand now. I'm grand. The worst of it, not the worst of it, but the bulk of it finished about 10 days ago. Yeah. And then, as always, I always get sick the minute I stop.
Do you?
It's kind of nice. Do you know what I mean? It's something that felt like COVID, but the tests were negative. I got to spend a week in bed, sweating and sleeping. And I knew I was coming to see you today. So over the weekend, I started kind of making myself be well. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, right. Yeah. You have a chore to do, so you better be well enough.
I need to be back to kind of be in the flow of life again. Mm. So I started then with the fizzy vitamin C and zinc over the weekend. And so now here I am.
That can be very nice, actually, can't
it? Do you know what?
Childhood-like.
Yeah. They have a new flavour of the fizzy vitamin C.
Right.
You know the way it's always been just orange
and
lemon, which I don't like either of them. They have elderflower now. They have notiony vitamin C.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
So it's kind of a watery looking one. And
well,
the
it's
colour.
Kind of like a pale green. No, it's very
it's nice.
Nice.
Yeah, it's a nice
yeah
colour.
You could put like maybe a slice of cucumber in it or something, and a straw maybe, you know. And yeah. Suddenly, like it's a festive occasion.
That's right. And we were supposed to be. Isn't there's an or in the month? So May would be the first month we can stop taking vitamin C.
Oh really?
I wouldn't risk it. At the
oh
minute.
God, no, not at all. Not in this country. Or the vitamin D. Like the vitamin D is the, isn't that the sunshine vitamin?
Oh yeah, well, we need that for sure.
Yeah, but like you're meant to take it during the winter months. But yeah. In Ireland, I would recommend taking it
are
all
you
year round.
Are you a good patient now when you're
oh,
sick
no,
and sweating in the bed?
No, I am the worst.
Right.
You know, I lie there yelling for things. You know, I like to eat my way through any discomfort.
Okay. Do you eat in the bed?
Oh, good God, yes.
I don't know about that now.
Oh, it's the best.
I'm going off you now altogether.
Oh, I mean, and I would often find crumbs. Oh, without, yeah, I'm happier.
Find you them know? Later, would you, the crumbs?
Oh, yes. Yeah,
oh,
yeah.
God.
No, I'm never comfortable with anything pristine. I like it to be sullied, you know, because then I can sort of relax. Then it's like, okay, right, the damage is done. I can enjoy myself now.
I have to clean a plate like when I'm finished.
Oh, okay, so right. I'm the opposite. I am the absolute opposite.
One of those people.
Yeah, I am the opposite of whatever you would call yourself, like a clean freak. You know, I kind of, yes. I'm one of these people who kind of goes around muttering that we wash ourselves too much. And no, like, I mean, I have to say, like, I do know my duties, you know, as a civilised person in a civilised society. Like, I do. But I'm always giving out about American soaps where people are always just going to take a quick shower. It's like, Stuart, you're grand. You're grand. You've had four already.
Yeah,
and
it's
only half
10
in the morning. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, settle.
What are you, Bob Dylan?
Yeah, exactly.
10 times a day or something. I think.
Oh, really?
I wonder, did he get over that? I don't know. He does so few interviews, we'll never find out.
We'll never find out.
He'll
yes.
grumble one day.
That's it. He'll write a groany old song about it. Yeah, I went to see him in The Point, whatever it's called these days, some years ago. And it was like he had the dry heave. All the way through it, like I don't know, he didn't make much of an effort. That's exactly it. Yeah, it did. It sounded like he'd enjoyed the day before, and he'd come then to do his concert. So I feel he was not a communicative man. So we'll never know about the overwashing.
So I'm at Nolan Park in Kilkenny. And you might be 3 minutes of the song and go, oh yeah, I know this one.
Yes.
Because he's kind of changed the way he
plays
his
that's hits. Right, that's right, yeah.
Like, how are you getting away with this?
I know.
We've paid in.
I know. I have to admit, I left at the half time. I just couldn't be, but it was just not pleasant. You know, and at this stage in my life, if I'm not enjoying it, good luck.
I know. God, I've nearly forgotten to do the interview.
Sorry, Solomon. Right, go on.
Are you following where it is in the charts, by the way? Is that the thing you do? Are you too many novels in at this stage?
Oh, no, I'm always. It's always, any time before a book comes out, I am always waiting for, I don't know, a backlash or just a lack of
backlash.
Interest.
Would you at this stage now be?
But, I mean, I think the longer you do something, the more likely it is, in a way, because I mean, I don't mean this in any kind. Like, people have been so good to me, and my readers have been so supportive and loyal. But like, fashions change, you know, what people like, it moves on, and I'm changing, and it just, people have their time, you know, and that doesn't last forever, no matter what we're doing. I don't mean this in a kind of a pessimistic way, but yeah. People have their time in the spotlight, and then inevitably that wanes. So I'm always very grateful that people have bought any books. But yeah, I was...
Shakespearean there.
Really?
The actor who struts and frets his hour upon the stage and then is heard no more.
But that's exactly it. I mean, it's for any of us, like, no matter what we do. I was delighted. I'm absolutely delighted.
It's brilliant. You've sold thousands and thousands. You're still number one in Ireland at the moment in our recent chart. And you're doing battle with David Nicholls.
I am. Were you talking to him?
We were chatting to him here a week or the week before. Yeah,
yeah,
when the book
he's
came
coming
out.
To Dublin.
He is, to this
I'm
festival.
Interviewing him.
Oh, it's your chatting to him. Oh, brilliant.
Yeah.
And you give a lovely blurb to the book.
Oh my God, it's a great book though.
Yeah, it is really good.
It's his best book.
It is. I actually read it and I thought it almost felt like a Marion Keyes.
Thank you.
I was reading it.
Thank you. Well, he writes love stories.
Yeah. Funny love stories.
Funny love stories, but he's a man.
He is, yeah, and the men, the male characters tend to be stronger as a result.
Yeah,
but it's unusual
yeah.
to have a man who gets to write books for women like that.
It is.
I think what do they say? Women love it, and he makes men cry, something like that.
Is that right?
Well,
I mean, I do think he writes about the vulnerability of men very well.
Yeah. You have a couple of vulnerable men in this one, don't you?
I do. Yeah, I mean, the kind of in my more recent books, I've become far less binary about how I view men. Mm. That they're either, you know, in my earlier books, they were either terrible human beings or they were like, you know, the savior, the you know, the man who comes in and fixes everything. And yeah, and now definitely my male characters are far more nuanced.
Particularly because you were talking there about how people change. And I'm fascinated by this because we do have we meet someone, we maybe know them from school or college or for a short period, and you just create the character for them.
Yeah.
And you freeze them there.
That's exactly it. Yeah, because the people I've written about in My Favourite Mistake are in their 40s and 50s, and they've known each other for a very long time. And definitely our idea of who a person is crystallises around the time we first met them.
Yeah.
And it's very hard in those long sort of friendships to change, or for a person to change and be re-accepted, you know, or to say, like, I was not a good person then, and I've worked very hard and I'm trying, and now I'm different and better, and please see me as I am now. So yeah, I wanted to write about, you know, the fact that we all do terrible things, all of us, no matter how well intentioned we are, and that we can do better, but that it is frustrating when people won't see us as having made those changes or trying or living, behaving differently.
Yeah. And it's also something we should probably remember about ourselves, that other people have crystallised the character
of who we are.
Of who we are.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yes. I mean, yes, of course. And that's also difficult if we feel like, I mean, I think most of us do. Most of us look back. I mean, OK, I look back at my earlier years, or not even that earlier, like 10 years ago, 15, 5 years ago.
That's right.
And think, I did things then that I really regret. And if I knew now, you know, back then, I wouldn't have done those things. But
of course,
life doesn't work that way. And it's about how do I manage those shames or those regrets. And in a way, My Favourite Mistake is very much about managing.
It is, yeah.
And kind of forgiving ourselves for our humanity, because we're all human beings and we are all flawed. And there is nothing, once we've made our amends as best we can to the people we've hurt, then it's about the bigger job of forgiving ourselves, which is an awful lot harder than forgiving others, I find.
I know. I mean, surely if you ever get out of bed at all, you've got to make mistakes, aren't you?
Completely. Like, it's inevitable. We're programmed that way.
Although now that I think of it, some of the mistakes are in the bed.
If you're me, exactly. Although I wouldn't consider them mistakes, do you see? I would consider them happy times. So it's, in a way, it's about how you view an act.
Are you thinking of sort of an excruciating moment or an excruciating time or thing you did? And what do we do then when we're now grown up, whatever age of grown-ups we are?
Yeah.
You just sort of have a chat with yourself, sit down in an armchair?
Yeah, have a chat with yourself or have a chat with somebody else, or maybe do something symbolic, like write a letter to the person you hurt, even if it's yourself. And then, I don't know, maybe burn it on the outside of the house if at all possible. But, you know, to do something to kind of just say, look it, I'm flawed because I'm human and so is everyone else. And I suppose to try and kind of keep it in perspective as well, you know, that you didn't do X, Y and Z, which would be miles worse, for example.
And you're going to make more mistakes.
Oh, that's the awful thing. That is the thing. Yeah, yeah, it's true. And again, I'm not able to avoid those things. And I suppose all I can do is, like, once I've done them, to not double down on them, but to kind of try and do better. Or to go back and apologise. That the power of an apology is so underrated. It's just a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
Like, it cleanses my soul. And it also kind of opens up, you know, clearer pathways. It means that for the rest of my life, I don't have to see that person and then run away down a dark alley hoping that they haven't spotted me. You know, it's hard to apologise, but it is so worth it.
It's hard to apologise and mean it. Is that fair to say?
Well, I suppose it involves that thing of kind of humbling yourself, you know, and thinking, oh, OK, right.
Here I am. Did the thing.
I did a bad thing. I wish I hadn't.
But there's good value to it.
There's great value. Yeah.
I mentioned when I was introducing earlier on that there's loads of milestones going on in your life.
Oh, yes.
Congratulations on 30 years sober. I think it was
in January,
yeah,
was it? Yeah, it was. Thank you.
Is that a huge moment? That must be a big moment.
It is a huge moment. I mean, at the same time, it is just one day at a time. Mm-hmm. It is just for today. But there was something about looking back at 30 years and seeing how dark my life had been in the final years of my drinking and just how much goodness and love and, I don't know, pride and lack of shame that there has been in the 30 years since. You know, with the caveat that, of course, I will continue to make mistakes because even though I'm sober, I'm still human. Yeah, but like, and so much goodness has happened. Mm. I mean, mostly in terms of relationships, because I couldn't feel love and I couldn't give love. Not when I was mired in, you know, active addiction and the whole self-obsession aspect of active addiction. So it has been so nice. Mm. And the fact that I'm aware of it makes it extra nice.
Of course, And the amount of people you've helped, even just talking about
Oh, God, I mean...
Extraordinary. And Rachel's holiday.
Oh, thank you. Do you know what? Like, I mean, like, I've only ever talked about myself, you know, and I never wanted to be one of these, do the way I did it, you know. I mean,
of course,
but it has been such a... God, it's been lovely to think... You know, because I do hear mostly about Rachel's holiday, you know, people who got sober or got clean, or else they understood people in their lives who had been maybe their parent or, you know, a spouse or child who had been through addiction and they had always blamed themselves that they should have tried harder or it was their fault that they made them be that way. And that they, you know, now they understand that, like, there was nothing that they could do. And that has been incredibly, what's the word, nourishing.
Yeah.
Knowing that, like, just by writing a book about, you know, the kind of the inside of living through addiction, that it's had that effect on people.
Yeah, it's lovely. I mean, you've told so much about yourself over the years, whether it's the addiction, depression.
Yeah.
The menopause more recently you've been talking about as well.
Yeah.
Does that help make all these novels more personal?
I mean, it's not anything I've ever set out to do. I mean, I have no boundaries and I never had. You know, I never had as a child. I didn't understand that there are things you don't say to people. And that I just always thought if somebody asked me a question, that it was only mannerly to answer it. I know that's kind of weird. And then I also think if I write about something and I'm then promoting the book, it's... I mean, again, plenty of writers don't do it, but I would rather give my side of things, or, you know, the research I did, and mostly, I mean, the research I did for addiction and depression, I lived through it, and also menopause. But, like, for me, I mean, in my favourite mistake, menopause is part of Anna's story, but it's only a small part. Mm-hmm. And I'm just trying to kind of go, well, you know, it happens to 50% of the people, of the population, and it is kind of... grim going through it, and we should be talking about it more.
Yeah.
And but let's not overdo it either, you know. I would just like it to be a sort of a normal thing.
It is, it's just casually in there, but it's obviously very important to her because the doctor's is mansplaining, going, you don't need the HRT.
I know. I mean, that happens to so many women.
I didn't know that type of side to it.
Oh my God. I mean, women are so infantilized when it comes to, like, their health. Mm. I mean, especially when it comes to reproductive health, you know, like childbirth. So few women get any say in how they really want it done. And this, I mean, with menopause, so many women have been told, you know, we're over-medicalizing something that, like, women have gone through since the dawn of time.
They sat there quietly in their house coat.
That's it, yeah.
Why can't you do
breaking
that?
Plates and like, shaping their beard, do you know? Whereas, you know, we didn't have antibiotics for a long time. And we didn't have anesthetics. And, you know, I'm delighted about general anesthetics, you know. If I'm going to have my leg amputated, I'd rather go with the medicalization approach. And it's just, you know, somebody who hasn't lived through it and who never will, I don't really think they have any right to tell somebody who is going through it and who knows their body and their mind very well. They have no right to tell them what they should or shouldn't do. You know, women are able to make their own minds up about what choices they make regarding their own health.
It's a legacy of men running this whole area, isn't it?
For
as long as we know science.
Well, I mean, you know, at the risk of saying patriarchy, we live in a patriarchy. Yeah. The world was built by men, for men. And it wasn't built to accommodate women. And, you know, now women are saying, we'd like to say how it is for us.
Yeah. Would the world have been saved by more feathery strokers in power?
Yes, it would. It would. Okay, people who don't know what feathery strokers are. It was invented by my sister Katrina and her friend Anne-Marie Scanlon. And feathery stroker is about a very, this was invented in kind of the early part of the century. A feathery stroker is a man who takes you to bed and, you know, he strokes you all night in a very feathery, gentle way. And he's, you know, he's very loving, very respectful. And that's all well and good. But there are people I know who would rather be flung around the bed and have a, you know, maybe an item of clothing torn. But feathery stroker was like, you know, when people would rather be kind of pile driven into a headboard, a feathery stroker was a terrible, terrible insult. Yes. And it was like became to kind of mean men who were good to their mothers, or men who went to Pilates, you know, or men who noticed that you'd had your hair cut, you know. And it became this sort of very you know, that they were just way too kind of sappy and gentle for their own good. But I think times have changed, and I'm all for a feathery stroker. I want a man who notices that I've had my hair cut and who is good to his mother, and, you know, and who will eat a dessert that isn't cheese. Do you know, who is kind of in touch with his feminine side?
I think the world wants, we're putting them on pedestals at the moment, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely.
Paul Mescal, who looks like he would do the aforementioned, but also there's a touch of the feathery stroker.
Oh, and there's nothing wrong with
soft men with muscles.
Yeah, you know, but I mean, they are the antidote to kind of toxic masculinity. You know, yay for the feathery strokers.
On that note, we're going to take a quick break and loads of messages coming through. I'll come to those in a second, but we'll chat after these. Oh, I was going to actually ask you what you're watching. We're with Marion Keyes, by the way, bestselling author, and because I wanted to ask what you read, because you read so much.
I do.
You have two or three at the same time.
Yeah. Well, I'm swatting for David Nichols at the moment because I'm interviewing him. But I just started reading the Gabor Maté book, The Myth of Normal, which is non-fiction. He's a doctor who's written a lot about addiction, and he's just so compassionate. Yeah. It's just a new way of looking at it.
And what else have you got, a couple?
Let me
see. Something you might have enjoyed. I'm putting you on the spot.
The new Vary McFarlane is coming in June. Oh, God, I love her books.
You have it already.
I asked her for it. I'm in the lucky position that, because I know other writers, and if I hear something is coming, send it to me, good woman.
And do you watch a bit of telly as well?
Oh, my God, I live for telly. I've just finished watching The Morning Show, the third series. My God, it just went batshit bananas by series three. I mean, it was, the first series was so good, and then it just went more and more insane. But in a way, I was there for it.
This was your illness watching, I presume.
Watching Ripley, watching One Day Again for the David Nichols swattiness.
The movie or the series?
No, the series. A thing about fancy hotels in India. Oh, stop.
Oh, that sounds great.
Oh, it's gorgeous. The Oberoi Hotels. Oh, listen. Yeah,
I haven't been. Have you been to India?
I have been to India a long time ago. Yeah, I'd love to go back.
It's supposed to be amazing.
Oh, it's just wonderful. I went on the trains. Go on the trains if you go. Yeah, people go for like 3-day train journeys, you know, to get from somewhere in the north to somewhere in the middle. And it's just wonderful.
Oh my, that's magical. So that's what you do.
The time off.
You've got your own Netflix thing, of course, happening.
Yes, I have. It's
another milestone.
I get you right. Okay, milestone. Yes. It's Grown Ups, my second ago novel. Yep. And it's going to
be a big novel.
Yeah, they all are, though. I mean, Jesus, I try not to, but they all come out big. But yeah, there's a lot of people in it.
No one's complaining.
Yeah.
A lot of people. So is this going to be a series or a film?
It's series.
Oh,
yeah, it's going to be
justice, yeah.
six different episodes. And I've seen their treatment in the first episode, and it's so good. And they're going to film in Ireland, and I'm hoping that it'll be an all-Irish cast. And we could have Paul Mescal maybe if he'd do us.
Yeah.
He could be the feathery stroker for
you. He'd be so good at it.
He'd be an excellent feathery stroker, wouldn't he?
He'd be amazing,
and we could get the chain its own... what's the word? Credit. And its own trailer.
Finally.
Yes. And its own makeup artist and everything.
Series.
Yes, exactly.
The other milestone I want to talk to you about is your house. Your house has been so important to you over for so many years.
Yeah. I mean, I lived where I did in Dunleary, as you know, for 27 years. But a year ago, I saw a house in the paper, and it was just the oddest thing. we'd wanted to kind of live in a modern house, and we lived in a Georgian house for a long time.
Bridget's fault in the novel.
Yes. And we just, I don't know. It's just one of those odd things because of our age, because I turned 60 and himself is 61. We kind of thought if we're going to move, we should be doing it before we're too decrepit to kind of, you know, make new friends and a new community and everything. So yeah. We saw this house and I just got a horrible feeling in my stomach and thought we're going to live there. I know that sounds, but I just was aware of all the upheaval and.
Oh, yeah, of course. It was just the most stressful thing in your life, isn't it, moving house?
Yeah. I mean, the most stressful thing was like seeing what came down from the attic. It was like there was a hole, an opening to hyperspace up there. Like just the amount of rubbish that just kept on coming. It was like being funneled in by the universe, like stuff going back like 30 years. And think, I cannot believe I exchanged money for this. And the utter mortification of the whole accumulating thing. So at the moment I'm very like, we'll give it all away, give everything away. And we did, we left most of our furniture and stuff
did
behind.
You?
Yeah.
So completely fresh.
Yeah. Yeah.
What a romantic way to pick up a newspaper, a physical newspaper.
Yes.
And go, there's the home I want to go to.
And then the minute, the first time we went there, I just knew it. I'd often heard people saying that the first time I walked in, I knew it was home. And I was like, yeah, me granny. Do you know, like you've got to check, like, are you near the bus? Are you near the dart? Like whatever. But it's right. Do you know, it's right.
So it's really ultra modern, loads of glass.
It's ultra modern. All straight lines and corners and glass and no attic. So you can't store roof. So it can't store. So that'll keep a
limit.
Will
you throw up wallpaper and nice things? Because you love
Yes, I do. It is. It's very funny. I have already started filling it with colour.
All fuchsia.
A lot of fuchsia, a lot of blue and green. Yes, Oliver, yes.
Well,
you know me well.
Thank you. Is it still somewhere in Dublin? Not looking for the air code.
No, it is in Dublin. It's sort of Ballantyre, Edmundstown.
Really revealing.
Yeah.
That's gorgeous. Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
To yourself and himself.
Thank you.
For that. And we've covered all the milestones now.
We have. My 60th birthday. Did we do that?
Yeah. And Keanu Reeves featured on buns or something.
Yes.
Sorry, I should say cupcakes.
Yes, I wish it was Keanu Reeves, but it was pictures of him going, what does he say in John Wick? Yeah. So they had him saying that. Do you not watch? Oh my God.
Did you watch the John Wick? Oh, we're obsessed.
I love it so much. I often watch it to cheer me up. You know, like other people might watch, I mean, I do watch Paddington as well when times are bleak. But an old John Wick's.
With all the violence and everything.
I love it, because of him.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, he's amazing.
He's gorgeous, isn't he? In every way, he has a good heart.
He is. He's just one of the good people.
He really is.
A feathery stroker for sure.
Utter and total.
But he can kick things in the face, and that's important.
I know. He's just the perfect man. He's an all-rounder.
He is. Through the headboard and out through the other wall.
Out into the street. Yes.
Now you're talking. That's a real man. That's a great place to be. Well, we'll have to say goodbye to Marion Keyes, but loads of people, and we're sorry to all the lovely people sending nice messages.
Yeah, I'm really sorry, and thank you to everyone.
Orlin Cork and June and Galway and Pat McLaughlin and Nora and another Marion actually sending in lovely messages. I'll read them to you afterwards.
Thank you.
Okay. Lots of people asking about your podcast with Tara Flynn.
Yes, it's called Now You're Asking. It's on BBC Sounds. Podcast. And we help people. You know, we're not really agony asks, but mostly we bring our own shambolic lives into play. And we're gearing up for series 4.
Oh, that's great news.
And we just love doing it. And we're so grateful for all the people who listen.
And I love how you sometimes almost explain to the British audience what you're talking about in the Irish way, but not quite. Let them look it up.
Exactly.
Listen, we have to go, but Marion Keyes, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
The International Literary Festival thing is on the 23rd of May, where you'll be talking to David Nicholls. That's blockbuster.
20th of May for David, 18th for me, which is 2 weeks from last Saturday.
Very good.
Or one week from next Saturday.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
You are all very welcome back. 51551, that's the text. Now, Parcels in the Post is what it's called. It's an unusual memoir in many ways. It's about my next guest's teenage years growing up in Castlebar in County Mayo with close to 50 siblings. Her name is Fiona Neary. She's sitting across from me. Good morning, Fiona Neary.
Good morning, Oliver.
What is all this 50 siblings about? But it's about foster care, isn't it?
And yes, it's about fostering. And we think actually we did more than 50.
Really?
Yeah, but 50 was a good round number. But we stuck with that.
There was no one keeping count. I'm sure there's a record somewhere, but just not in your busy, busy home.
Well, you see, some foster children, they leave you and then they come back. So does that count as one placement or two?
Yeah.
So, yeah.
What era are we talking about in terms of the foster care coming in and out so we can get a view of Ireland And what the situation was like in the country, I suppose.
Yeah, so like a lot of Irish immigrants, my parents left Ireland in the late 60s and returned in the late 70s.
Very good.
And to Caislonawarry, Condhuaio. And not long after that, my mother made the executive decision with very little consultation of anyone else.
Zero, in fact.
And she connected with the local community nurse because it wasn't even social workers back then. And we started taking in babies. So I'm still trying to figure out quite where we fitted in terms of the Magdalen Laundries and all of that journey.
Yes, I'm very curious about that.
Yeah, so the first, well, we had lots and lots of babies. That's, you get the numbers up quite quickly with the babies, because the baby, the mothers would, or girls, girls or women would give birth in the local hospital. And after 3 days or so, the baby would come to us for about 6 weeks. And
right.
Back then, that was the period of time that women and girls had to decide whether to give the child away or not. So a lot of the pregnancies were secret or hidden, or maybe the teenager had gone to stay with an aunt or a relative, and it was all kept very quiet. And for many of them, sure, they'd no choice really in either the pregnancy or whether or not to adopt. So we had lots of babies, beautiful little babies.
In many ways, your home is like the missing piece of the jigsaw, isn't it? In that story of Ireland in the 70s, where the babies kind of went away for a few weeks. While the teenage girl and her family, you know, because she didn't really have much of a say in it, did she?
Well, as we understand now, very, very little. And then that began to change because, well, so we'd be coming home from school. There could be a child, there might not be a child, there might be two babies. You know, we got used to it very quickly. Yeah. And so they're very adorable.
So this was the exact decision your mum made.
Uh-huh.
But the context is that is having met your dad, your mum met your dad in England.
No, they met in Ireland.
Oh, they met actually. In Ireland, did they?
Yeah,
okay,
yeah,
sorry.
Yeah.
And so, what's the English part of the life?
When I started writing this, my mum had passed away, so I could interrogate everyone except her.
Yeah,
kind of gave out to her for exiting without me getting all the information I needed. But Dad kind of pieced it together, and he thinks, you know, we were very good Catholics in North London, went to Mass every Sunday, and Dad said, "Mam saw women at Mass with different babies, different children," which was exactly how our neighbours subsequently saw us in Ireland, and she became curious, and she had the opportunity at one point to ask that woman. And that's how she started to hear about fostering.
Yeah, and the idea grew.
Yes, and also the fact that there was money, it was paid.
Yes.
So it was a pittance. There's no two ways about that.
Yeah, but I wouldn't say she was doing it for much of a profit.
No, but still, it brought a little bit of cash into the house, and cash was king.
And a bit of freedom for her as well, I presume.
Yeah, well, to some extent, she was tied in one sense, in that she was now tied more to the house with the babies.
I see. Yes.
But it brought in a bit more cash. Mm. But in the late 70s, that lovely title, the Unmarried Mother's Allowance, came in. And that was the first thing that began to give those women and girls a little bit of space and to have a little bit more input into decision making. And it gradually began to make some difference. Of course, some of the women were still going to England and all that. But we began then to have toddlers and older than toddlers. And sure, they get up to much more mischief.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah.
And what about the other children, her own children, her birth children in the house?
Sure. We suffered awfully. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, so we were always older than the foster children that came into the house. So I was 10, my sister was 8 and my brother was 6. So, and we had always been, the three of us had always been the three of us in London. And, you know, so we had a good sense of us as a family before all the fostering started. So often when people are thinking about fostering, they often ask me, and I'm always kind of quick to say to them, look, I only know about fostering from always having been the oldest, the bossiest, the most irritating, you know. I don't know what it's like if you're in a family that fosters children older than the birth children,
right,
or around the same age. So, you know, the journeys of birth children are really different. So, yeah.
And were you at an age where you had to help out? Because it was a busy household.
Yeah, Yeah, oh yeah, you just got on with it. And I've said this a few times, but my parents are from farming backgrounds. Mm. They both left school very early and they both worked very hard. Mm. So their way of living was you just get on with it. There's no great fuss, you just get on with it. So that's what we did with the kids. We just got on with it.
Work was the responsibility.
Yeah, yeah. And it was just the way of things.
But she obviously enjoyed it because she kept fostering, didn't she? She had quite a career as a foster parent.
She did. And I think as it gave way to more and more older children and teenagers, of course, then you're beginning to have situations where social workers are coming on a Friday and they've nowhere to put the children. So now we know that when there's nowhere to put children, they go into bed and breakfasts or unregulated accommodation because the situation is just as in crisis now as it was then. So back then, when there was nowhere to place a child on a Friday evening, social workers finish work at 5 o'clock, the children would be admitted to a hospital.
Wow.
Yeah. So we would know, well, you'd be coming home from school on a Friday and you'd see a car outside the house and be all right, here we go. So, yeah, they would come to the house and they would be there. They'd know where to place the child. So Mam was a bit like, Asher, look, we'll fit them in somewhere, we'll manage. And for some of those children, it was a very short emergency stay. Mm-hmm. But we eventually had some children, siblings separated across a couple of houses and there was nowhere else for them. So an emergency placement that was supposed to be a weekend or a couple of weeks could become a couple of months, a year, a couple of years.
Yeah. And how did everyone get along in the house? Because obviously...
Well, of course, the one who hogged the bathroom the most was the one we hated the most.
Right.
Yeah, it was mixed. I mean, on the one sense, I was quite giddy as a kid, so I kind of loved the action. And I was also beginning to get into a bit of divilment and I was kind of delighted that Mum was distracted.
Yes, okay.
The heat was off me and I could get up to divilment. And my mum worked in a chip shop at night time. Yeah. So everyone told her everything. So it was very hard for me to get away with anything. So this was great. She was now distracted and I could be, a teenager. So there was that side to it. But the other side of it was much more serious, was that, you were beginning to realise that, the kids you were walking up the road to school with in the morning, their bags were a hell of a lot heavier than yours. You knew you were going to school worrying about taking the mickey out of the teacher in biology and they were going to school knowing that there was a court case coming,
right,
that there was a sibling still at home in a house where they hadn't been safe. We were gradually exposed to the family law court system, mm-hmm, and a social work system that was heavily under-resourced. And you began to see really clearly that, when children come into care, they really need the best of us as a community. They deserve the very, very best of us, of what we can give them. And that is not what happens. Mm. So we began to see how catastrophic it can be for children in care. And that became increasingly difficult.
The kids were victims of neglect and abuse, things that we didn't have any vernacular for, vocabulary for in this particular era, did we?
Yeah, it was all, I think on one level, the secrecy was about trying to protect people in the best possible way. Mm. But there were a lot of things then that nobody talked about that were all in our kitchen. So it was domestic violence, mental health issues, addiction, very serious addiction issues and the consequences of that in families. Serious neglect, sexual violence, all of those things began coming into our house. And so this was now reality in our house, but not anywhere else. You didn't see it anywhere else in Ireland. Yeah. So you were living this kind of two-step life. Your life at home was behind the curtain. And then once we left the house, we were back out in the world. And we also knew not to talk about the children. We had to keep them... We had to protect their confidentiality as well. So that became quite a battle in writing a book, how to try and write about fostering, because there's so much people don't know about what happens to children when they come into care and they're so at the mercy of that system. But at the same time, you're doing everything to protect their confidentiality and their dignity.
That's the crux of it, isn't it? You can't tell the stories. But what you can do, what you've done with this book is describe the effect it had on you, which you probably didn't realise much until you went into the research.
Yeah, looking back on it, I realized I kind of began to feel sorry for anyone who was around me in my 20s.
Really?
Because, or as an older teenager, I became very, very impatient for change. You know, I just needed it to change. The secrecy, the cover-ups, and the way that children were being treated, I was quite angry and quite impatient.
Yeah.
And I had no idea what to do with that. You know, like I was punching in so many directions and the only person I was punching was myself, really.
Mm.
But yeah, I was very impatient. And that did lead to discovering another amazing woman, Ruth McNeely, and opening a rape crisis centre locally, which just celebrated its 30th anniversary.
Congratulations. We were only talking about 1994, 1995, that whole period of modernisation in Ireland.
Yeah.
That's the era you're talking about.
Yeah.
We finally just wake up.
Yeah, it was fantastic in a way. Like we opened, we didn't know it at the time, but certain things were beginning to break through in Ireland. And it was, you know, things like sexual violence in the family really began to be understood. And to some extent, I think it's still the whole thing of what do you do if somebody in your family has sexually harmful behaviour. I don't know if that pathway for a family is still clear, but at least now we are able to talk about these things openly. They happen in every family. Children are harmed in families in Ireland. So we have to be able to talk about these things and ask for help.
When you set up the Rape Crisis Network in Castlebar in that era, did you have a lot of opposition from, because I know this is an era where politicians over in that part of the world weren't known for their relationship with feminism.
Well, it didn't always manifest as active opposition. It was often a kind of indifference or what would you be at? You know,
there wasn't active
support. Yeah, we did have difficulty renting a premises for a while.
That's
and
right.
You were constantly being asked, sure, is there much of that? There was a huge minimising. But of course, what I knew from our kitchen and even from going to school, from girls in school, was that there were, you know, we think some things are very modern. We think family breakdown, infanticide, addiction, all of these things. We think these things are very modern and they're not. You know, we knew all about these things back then, but we just did not talk about them.
We didn't want to acknowledge what was right before us.
Yes, and the more of them went off to England and took care of themselves over there, the better. So, you know, there was So the teenager in the book, I think what we see happening for me as a teenager is that I want everything to be very black and white. I want there to be the angels and the devils.
Well, you're exposed to the truth, aren't you, as a teenager?
Yes, because gradually I met some parents and I was, you end up in situations where you're in the company of family and parents who have harmed children. And you get to see that that's not black and white either. So there is an element of the teenager maturing and beginning to see that it's not all as black and white as angels and devils.
Are you glad now, looking back, that you were sort of awakened at such a young age, or a little bit resentful that you didn't have the sort of innocent, ignorant childhood maybe that some people had?
Yeah, there was a losing of innocence in some ways. But no, I love that we fostered. And even, you know, since the book came out, and it's only out a few days, I was in Dunn's and a woman approached me in Dunn's. And she told me about a connection she had with my family.
Really?
And it was just so moving. And I mean, my mother was no saint. She loved a bit of the crack and she was, you know, there were rules, there were limits, you know. But this woman just approached me and said that during a very, very difficult time in her life when she was very lost, that my mother supported her. And you're just like, I'm so glad I come from that family. That's, yeah.
Your mum was pretty close to a saint.
I don't know. She was. No, I would say, I think my mother, she was ferociously practical.
Yeah.
And she was very kind. That was the measure of her in some ways. Yeah. And I really love that she did what she did.
You didn't get to have that conversation with her?
No, I didn't. Yeah, and it sounds strange to say it, but I'm glad that there has been a 10 years since my mother passed away and the book has come out, because it took us all an awful long time to you know, be able to be ourselves again after Mum passed away. But yeah, there's a launch event in Galway on the 16th in Charlie Burns. And of course,
we're great place
Charlie
to
Burns.
Do it. Yes,
yeah, 6 o'clock
beautiful,
on
beautiful
the
bookshop.
Next, yes, tomorrow week. But tomorrow night we're having an event in Castlebar. And
hugely important.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of my family coming. My dad is coming. Some foster families that fostered around the time that we did are coming. And that's all in the fabulous Linen Hall Arts Centre,
which you are involved in, obviously.
Yeah, I never imagined this could happen, but I have the absolute pleasure and joy of being co-director of the Linen Hall Arts Centre. And it's interesting how it comes full circle, because the local Mayo Tusla, we partner with them around some excellent projects about siblings separated in foster care. And that's one of the things I explore in the book, that sometimes, you know, children arrived into our house together. But then because of court orders or other situations, siblings are separated from each other. Mm. And that is
desperate.
Yeah.
Your dad gave you the title for the book.
Yeah, he did. We were on the phone one day. I was, "Dad, do you remember such and such? Do you remember this?" And he was talking about a particular situation, and nobody, including this child, knew where that child was. It was Friday. Nobody knew where that child was going to live and sleep on the Monday, or where they were going to go to school, including the child. So we were talking about that, and Dad just made this offhand remark. He said there were like parcels in the post sometimes.
Yeah.
And I had a pen in my hand and I just wrote it down. And then years later, when I was thinking, what am I going to call this?
Parcels in the post.
Yeah.
Which it says, it's such a loaded thing, isn't it? It says so much about what you've described to us. That's how the state, how the institutions treated these kids.
I think that social workers and the state and institutions think they're doing their best, but without proper resourcing, it's just not good enough. We have to do better for children in care. We have to support families that are struggling more in the first instance, so those children don't come into care if they don't need to. And then we really have to support foster families, because there are 5,000 children in care, Oliver, in Ireland.
Yeah, right now.
Right now. Mm. So there are thousands of foster families going through these journeys right now.
Someone's already in touch here. Maureen from O'Hill says, "We've great families like that lady and her mother all over Ireland now. We know them. They do their great work quietly, not looking for any adulation." After your experience, would you recommend fostering for people to take part in?
I don't think it's for everyone, but I really would. I mean, I've considered it myself, and only for a couple of things. I haven't done it, and I still might. I think sometimes you can have a lot more love to give than you might think. And I think that's what my family discovered. And these kids really are amazing. What they bring into your life is really quite powerful and incredible. So I think if anyone is thinking about it, speak to somebody who has fostered, because foster parents have an incredible network. They're an incredible network of support for each other. So I would say connect with other foster families and get some sense of it.
Fostering Ireland would be a good place to.
Yeah,
to
Irish Foster Care Association. Yeah.
You have a phrase, when you welcome a child into your house, you love that child, even if sometimes you don't like that child.
Oh, God. Well, you know, my thing as an obnoxious teenager was I hated all of them on Thursdays when Top of the Pops came on.
What's that?
They were noisy, and that was my time. And, you know, who now even remembers Top of the Pops? And I, you know, don't touch my record collection, you know. And I was telling someone yesterday, there's a story in the book that was eventually there were children in the house I never met because I'd gone to college.
Yes, okay. And I carried on.
Yeah.
It shows the breadth
right.
of time. Yeah.
Yeah. So some children actually came and went then while I was at college. But I came home one time and I found a diary of mine. And some little obnoxious yoke. Oliver, not alone had they found my diary, but they had written comments. They had critiqued me. They had written comments in my diary. With these really bad misspellings. So I wanted to slaughter them. At the same time, I was just so amused by the misspellings in a green pencil, if you're out there.
You were lucky it happened at that time. If it was teenage years,
I know. Yeah, so imagine this person I still have never met. It was stayed in my home for a while, read my diary and critiqued it in green pencil with bad spellings, Oliver.
Outrageous. But otherwise, she had a wonderful time when she recommends it. It's called Parcels in the Post. Growing up with 50 siblings, as we've realised, probably more. Fiona Neary, thank you so much for sharing the story and the unique vantage point that you had in that that period in Ireland. Thanks so much. And that's out now, Parcels in the Post.
Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.
And you are all very welcome back. 51551 is the text. Oliver at RTE.ie. You know what to do by now. A comedian, podcaster, runner, kidney donor, writer, Jarlath Regan. Welcome to studio,
Oliver,
sir.
It's so great to be here. And it's so great to hear you referring to the Three Arena as the Point Depot.
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, that's old age at this stage.
Re-branding. I was like, yeah, you just won't let the branding in.
And you're at the Olympia Theatre, and it's not called anything else.
It's the Olympia Theatre at the end of the month. Yeah, good. Get the plug in early.
The
I like
Olympia,
it.
Yes. The Olympia. Olympia Theatre, thank you. That's in May. Come here. Jarlath is our visiting critic, which is our non-traditional, non-professional critic who goes outside their comfort zones. All comedians are dorks. I would have thought science fiction, like, come on, would be a forte.
Wouldn't you? Yeah.
They're but almost just hovering, trying not to reference it too many times.
I think that there's quite a lot of people in Ireland who were raised in homes where science fiction was looked at with raised eyebrows. What's this all about? Is this a true story, is it? That's what my father used to say when something science fiction came on. Is this a documentary? Set in space. And I'd be like, yeah, it happened last week, but we weren't really allowed to watch it, right? For that reason, it was considered American nonsense. So it never became a thing. I was not into Doctor Who, Star Wars, no. Star Trek, all passed me
entirely
by.
Entirely gone.
All of it.
Was there an aggression in the house towards us? Would it be a flick off?
Just a general apathy. I mean, they were into sport. We watched sport. Whatever sporting event, we ran the year around the calendar. Roland Garros, Wimbledon, FA Cup, and of course the horse racing. And that's fine. I loved it and I love sport. But I guess there's only so much room.
Even the sports that seem to have been fragmented off, like we used to always watch, like darts, snooker, show jumping.
Yeah.
It was just all happening, wasn't it?
Well, I guess it was. Vintage. We did. Look, RTE Sports had a lot to answer for. I mean, it was like Sports Stadium and the amount of coverage they gave to every type. There was Trans World Sport was the thing they had on. Yeah. So you got to see all these weird sports from around the world. So I guess
superstars.
When my father was a sportsman himself. So I guess when you're in that results-based thing, if science fiction doesn't enter your life early, it can just be a thing you don't get. And that was my way.
So did you sort of, because other kids, I presume, were talking about Star Wars and stuff.
Yeah, I think I even had an R2-D2 that somebody gave to me and I didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know what this referred to.
It was like when we had like the Simpsons Sing the Blues CD, having never seen the Simpsons.
You never watched the Simpsons?
Because it was on Sky, like we couldn't see it.
Oh my God, Oliver.
Well into the 90s.
Now, there are science fiction people listen to this now going, oh my God, guy didn't watch Star Wars till he was 20. He didn't watch the Simpsons.
I was in the cinema till I was 12. Oh my first trip to the cinema. What was the film? Actually, Into the West was the first thing I saw in the cinema. And it was because it was an altar boy and there was a bus trip and they brought us to the cinema in Dundalk, which when you look at it, was only 10 clicks away.
Forget the plan to talk about science fiction, Oliver. We need to talk about this.
I know. I need to lie down.
You didn't know cinemas existed until you were 12.
I knew it was just we weren't allowed to go there. It was like Florida. I know it exists.
Smoke.
No hope of ever attending. And then sure, I haven't stopped since.
Yeah, look, that's the thing.
So you never went to see Star Wars?
Never. Didn't watch it till college.
You were literally in college?
I was in college and I was living with a guy from Cork and he was as shocked as anyone. His jaw's on the floor. And he was like, well, we're going to rectify this.
So there was a DVD producer?
Yeah, there was a lot. There was like, I was kind of forced to sit through a few things and it just, I think one of the things that troubled me straight away with it was how matter of fact they were about how odd everything was. Like you arrive on a planet with people with large heads. Nobody ever calls back to base. We've arrived to discuss matters with the consulate. You should see the size of these guys' heads.
They never do. They're all speaking English.
Yeah. And remarkably, they speak the Queen's English. I mean, I guess it just was off the frequency. And I went through my 20s.
So you just said, that's not for me, thank you.
Yeah,
glad just, my family just gave me sport.
And even like Tolkien and Lord of the Rings, the Mordor and all that stuff. It's just like, I was into factual based things and just couldn't see the attraction. And that's why I'm here today, to talk about the movie that changed all.
Yes, indeed. So we said, what is out of your comfort zone? You explained all of this to us. And we said, well, we have to get you back into Star Wars to see how it feels.
Yeah.
What did you watch?
Rogue One, Star Wars Story.
Good choice.
It's a 2016 movie that isn't in the, you know, the trilogies.
Yes, and it's a standalone film, so you can go into it, but it features Darth Vader, as you can imagine now.
Wars it's like a, it's a prequel, right? So everybody will know the death. Like, even people who aren't into Star Wars, this is the perfect movie, right? Because you'll know the Death Star is a big yoke that can blow
up
planets.
It's like a moon shaped spaceship hanging up there.
It's a spaceship. Massive.
Destroys planets. Yes. Darth Vader used to use it with a big laser.
And Luke Skywalker fired one perfect shot to blow the whole thing up. Now, everybody knows that.
It's been copied in so many movies ever since.
Yeah.
It's an enormously complicated security system. It's got one tiny flaw.
One chink in the armor. But it does raise that question, like, why is there the chink? Like, I was like, who didn't cover over that little spot with a bit of plywood to stop that from happening?
Is that what Rogue One is about? Did you
Rogue
discover?
One is all my dreams come true that way, because it's like the architect, the fella that designed the thing. I'm like, who designed this yoke? Like, Darth Vader's not an architect. This movie is about how this was designed by a lad who realised this is only going to bring misery. I'm out of here. So it's like a Dermot Bannon show in many ways.
Right.
The architect has absconded and said, I'm not finishing the project. This house is a disaster. This is literally the beginning of the movie. He is on another planet in hiding with his wife and his child. And he's saying, I'm not doing another tap of work on that Death Star house. It is only going to bring you way over budget as it is. Right. They arrive on the planet, and this is the other thing. It does not look like a Star Wars movie. They arrive on this planet, and it just looks like real. It looks real. It looks like they're flying into this with the spaceship, and they are living in seclusion. And he basically kills the wife and says to him, "You're coming back here to build this house, whether
Darth
you like
Vader
it or not."
Collects Dermot Bannon.
It's not Darth Vader. It's another fella. General Krennic, I believe his name is, shows up and says, "You're coming back. I'm bringing the whole family, whether you like it or not."
I've seen this in the cinema, and I'm already forget.
Yeah, but so the kid goes running for the hills. There's a plan already to have the kid hide in the hills. He's no option but to go back. Long and short of it is, he goes back to build this yoke, and he builds it with one chink in the armor.
Oh, so Dermot Bannon says, "Look, I'm going to finish it off.
I'll finish it. Yeah. But I'm going to leave one weakness in it." And this whole thing of Star
Wars...
That
explains the 1977 film.
Yes, exactly. So the plans, they need to get the plans for the Death Star so they can identify where the spot is. But like, you're like, who? Where did those plans come from? This is the story of how they got the plans, how the girl that went into hiding is a grown woman now, and she's a brilliant rebel in the Alliance. I can't tell you, Oliver, how little time I had for Star Wars until I watched this movie. Suddenly... It's real. It's more like a Saving Private Ryan Vietnam style heist movie to get to that planet where these files are being held.
To discover what the flaw is.
To get the plans. So
Dermot Bannon is gone
them.
At this stage.
It's already Dermot Bannon's. Dermot father, unfortunately, he comes to a bad end in it. But the daughter and himself. I'm going to ruin the whole thing here. The daughter and himself do get reunited.
Ruining anything, because it's a fantastic ending to this film. Most unexpected.
It is. You will never see the ending coming. That's true.
No, you won't. And come here. There's a producer somewhere in RT going, "Oh, Dermot Bannon does have children. This could be. This could run and run.
This could do this." Yeah.
Someone's already texting in saying, "Hello, I told my son recently I hadn't watched any of the Star Wars films." He said, "I hope you haven't told anyone this." Michael and Boyle.
Yeah, don't.
Charlotte, you are a father.
I have a son. He's 13 years old, and he got into Star Wars Lego.
Cartoons. That was the entry. Yeah.
So that was the entry level for him. And I think it was my cousin Morris who I have to blame for that, because that...
I just saw your facial expression there going, "I have to blame that's a cousin."
He is the one who said, if he doesn't like Star Wars, he'll love Star Wars Lego. And like, that is hilarious cartoon.
The
like,
Regan family dynasty.
He adored that straight away. And, you know, it was the whole time. Like, with your kids, you are a lot of the time going, yeah, this is a wonderful movie. You spend a lot of your life going, yeah, let's watch it again.
So you pretended to and watch it.
Yeah, so I was enduring these movies.
What age? It's young Mikey, isn't it?
Young Mikey. What age was he in? Shout out to him. Well, I mean, he was into it from the age... Well, he would have been 5 when this movie came out. So he was on board by the age of 4. And,
oh, wow.
Okay. You know, lightsabers all over the house and, you know, figures everywhere.
This is great. And you resisted this whole thing.
I'm going, like, I'm buying all the figures and going, like, why is it, when is this going to, because you assume this will fade out, right? It's not going anywhere. And I went to see this Rogue One movie in 2016 between shows at Leicester Square. And I was like, literally, there was nothing else on. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to have to go to a Star Wars movie.
So at least I can chat to my child about it.
Came home raving about it. So if you are not into Star Wars, this is the movie that will turn you.
Unexpectedly, Rogue One. Because
Rogue One,
there isn't 15 movies beforehand, there aren't a load afterwards.
It's a standalone adventure. And
for the Star Wars fanatics, they were just delighted that it was a new thing that had old Darth Vader in it.
Made sense of things. They used CGI to make other characters who had since passed away, since 77. There are certain people that you're trying to cast your mind back because you wouldn't spot it.
Yeah, the old guy in the general... Yeah.
100% CGI, you would never pick it.
I think I remember the time going, no, his head looked a bit wobbly now.
Yeah, there's always a movement, isn't there? Yeah, that isn't quite right. Your eye has a weird radar for it. And then, of course, as you mentioned, the big lad shows up. Darth Vader, the person my son was obsessed with.
Yeah.
And I mean, I was always like, what's so scary about this lad? Like, what, he can choke people with his hand standing across the room? Like,
that's pretty scary.
This movie shows you what an absolute horrid,
very good,
dangerous individual he was. We never actually get to see him wreck lads, like fully trounce people and smash them around the
family,
room.
Yeah.
Yeah, we want to see him do a Jackie Chan kind of force version of that.
Without even hardly moving from the spot.
With barely any
class.
Effort. And that scene, as a little bit of trivia, was only tagged on to this movie. So they wanted a happy ending. The director said, I assume Disney, you're going to want a happy ending. And Disney came back and said, no, we want something more tragic. And also, he said, can you stick a little more Darth Vader in there? And he wrote a scene, like, if there's one reason to watch this, it's to see Darth Vader flex his muscles.
Heads are cracked.
It's like a minute-long chaos.
Minute-long Ulster final with Darth Vader.
Yeah, you know that clip of Mayo and Kerry shouldering each other at the start before the throw-in. It's that times a million. Yeah, amazing.
Fantastic. So this is a rave review for Star Wars. Now
it is.
Are you going to watch any more? Are you going to enter? Because there's quite a lot.
Yeah, like I'm definitely was on board from that point forward. And we did enjoy the new movies. But Mikey is a big lad now. He's moved on to bigger things.
Oh, has he?
You know, he still has a Lego Death Star in his bedroom, which he's very proud of. Biggest build he's ever done.
We know from friends of ours, you can keep that going to middle age.
It's a biggie.
They shouldn't, but they can.
It's an obsession. But it's still there for him. And it's still something like, I had people message me about this when I mentioned that I was going to be talking about Rogue One. Grandparents saying that they went to see the original Star Wars in 77.
Interesting.
And now they're teenage grandchildren, they're enjoying it all again. So it does span the generations. I would have to say that the most recent series that they've put out on Disney are probably the best things.
You think the series they've done?
Yeah.
Which one?
Mandalorian.
The Mandalorian is fantastic. Yeah. It's a Western, isn't it?
It is.
It's just a Western.
You know, like another way of looping people in.
Have you watched Andor? That's very good.
Not yet.
Yeah,
now, that'll tell you.
Heists and thrillers in it. Yeah, right. Well, very good. A political kind of.
So you've watched that?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah.
Right.
And it's connected somewhat to Rogue One.
Okay. You've got me.
Yeah.
I'm on board.
But which is slightly annoying because you're going to go, hang on, no, that was the standalone. Leave it alone.
Yeah.
No, this was a series. There was kind of poor enough series, I would have thought. Boba Fett wasn't very well.
That definitely did not go down well, didn't receive good reviews. But this Andor thing, I find that 13, I don't know about you, is a real transition age for a lot of people. A lot of people can remember their 13th year in their life.
That's right, yeah.
So, you know, my son's definitely moved away from Star Wars, and I have held
the
candle.
He's now an architect.
Yes, he's now into. He actually does love Room to Improve. Ugly House to Lovely House is his favourite TV show.
There is a third person in this family.
There is.
How does she fit into the Star Wars universe?
Tina, my wife, is...
Who's here. She's looking at behind the glass.
Through the glass there. Honestly, she's the one going, Jar, you cannot complain about his obsession with Star Wars when every time you go on the road to do a show, you arrive back with more Star Wars Lego. You're like, why is he so into this? Because you keep buying it for him. Look, she definitely was into it before me. She knew more about it than I did and kind of couldn't understand because I think there was a higher tolerance to it in her house. Her father, Mick Rowland, give him a shout out, 74th birthday today. This may be the last broadcast I do now that I've revealed that. he didn't seem to be that big on it, but she definitely is a fan. And this is the other thing about Rogue One. It's quite like Alien in that there's a strong female lead in this who kind of puts the Rey character in The Force Awakens to shame. She plays this role of somebody who's orphaned early in life and neglected to come back and be this hero at the end of this movie. That, like, it's a movie about hope. That's the other thing. It's a movie about rebels, hope against hope in a war that doesn't look winnable. So if ever there's a movie for today, this is it.
And crucially, she doesn't study architecture.
She doesn't.
Kids, you don't always need the Leaving Cert.
She's lived in a cave for a lot of her life.
Someone says, true story, we were always a Star Wars family. This is a text. And I introduced the kids to it from early days while visiting my grandmother, who's now passed away over 15 years ago. My youngest, who was then 6 years old, spotted a framed photo of Padre Pio in her hallway. We can see where this is going. Jack pulled my arm and said, Dad, why does Granny have a picture of Obi-Wan Kenobi in her hallway?
Amazing. And definitely not the only person who thought that.
That is,
I remember seeing the robes
now
and thinking, that's such a cool Jedi robe.
Oh my god.
Right.
And you can get a piece of the robe inside a little laminated card because Obi-Wan Kenobi had stigmata.
Oh god.
We'd like to apologise in advance of that official complaint. That's from Shane Fennessy. Thanks for that.
You're nearly apologising as you say things.
Welcome to the State Broadcaster. What are you up to? By the way, you're the original gangster podcaster, aren't you? Because you, the Irishman Abroad, that must be one of the oldest podcasts in existence.
I think it was one of the first Irish ones, yes. Yeah. Irishman Abroad started in 2013. And
really?
Yeah. Wow. And I really was trying to make sense of life abroad through the help of the people in my phone book. So, you know, it started with the likes of Dylan Moran, Jason Byrne, Des Bishop, and it extended out to Gabriel Byrne, Sir Rob Geldof, Mary Robinson, Sharon Horgan, and it just kind of grew a life of its own. And since coming back, we've obviously spun it out into three spin-offs.
You
podcasts.
Do, yeah. So yes. You have the running one, obviously.
With Sonia O'Sullivan.
Yeah, Sonia. And
the American one, Irishman in America,
with
Marion McKeown, Making Sense of America every Friday. And my wife, we do a parenting podcast called Honey, You're Ruining Our Kid.
And do they all go concurrently or how do you?
At one point I was putting out 3 to 4 episodes a week.
That's nice.
And yeah, and trying to tour as well. So that was really burning the candle at both ends. Now it's 2 episodes a week. And I'm really delighted to say that the big interviews will be coming back soon. I can't talk about that just yet.
Very good.
But there'll be a big development there shortly.
But what I like is that you are an original podcaster because you're in the comedy circuit, but your kind of fame came from the podcast in many ways, didn't it?
I don't know about the word fame, Oliver. People knew me.
The branding.
That's how people knew me.
People knew me. Whereas, you know, now podcasts are such a saturated market. It's like people we know from mainstream media anyway. Yeah. Now doing interviews with the same people they've already interviewed.
You know what's happened
so
to me in the last 12
rubbish,
months?
Rubbish, isn't there?
Well, I don't want to say that. There's podcasts for everybody, right? There really is. Like literally, you can put into that podcast search engine whatever you're into. If you're into Rogue One, there is probably a Rogue One podcast that will deep dive into how this thing was made. I just find it so strange now to meet people at shows because, like, I'm touring the Your Man stand-up show that you mentioned at the start everywhere from Boston, Chicago and New York to London. And people that come to these shows don't know about the podcast.
Oh, is that right?
So they're into the stand-up.
So they're catching you where?
So I come meet them afterwards and I go, you should listen to the podcast if you like the show. And they're like, you have a podcast? that's fine because we'll get the two to come together.
TikTok, Instagram
and that. Yeah, like it is amazing.
You're quietly one of the biggest, not an influencer, I suppose you call yourself, but quietly one of the biggest Instagram. You've about 250,000 people
on
Instagram.
In a very short period of time. It is remarkably
10 years.
The new... very short 10 years. But like really that's only kind of kicked off in the last year for me.
Yeah.
And it was just posting the jokes. Like not much has changed. I'm still doing the same jokes. Just people, we got eyeballs on it.
With a warning about jokes when you're doing it.
Oh, there is a warning in there about modern comedy needing to let people know that they're coming to hear jokes. This is a safe space. Like that's what I say to people when they come to the show. It's like, just I want you to come and laugh like a drain for 90 minutes
and really
forget everything. A full distraction in a safe place where we know I'm joking and I'm not going to be saying anything that is going to make you go, oh, I don't know.
The kind of peak progressive fear of jokes, it feels like it's past now. It was sort of 2015, 2017.
Look, was it a bad thing or was it a good thing? I don't know, because really I think it was a more of a sensitivity to the impact.
Yeah.
Potentially,
yes.
Of jokes and how they cultivate an atmosphere. Like we all know people right now who are still saying jokes to us that we're like, that's not funny. That's not, you shouldn't be joking about that in this context.
But the market has decided they're fine.
Yeah. I kind of think that kind of peak period of cancellation of people for things, there were probably some stuff that shouldn't have been out there, let's be honest. Like there were certain British comedians that were selling themselves as offensive comics.
Yeah. I suppose what the correction has done is that it's brought us female comedians surging into the marketplace and women going to comedy to watch whatever they want. That feels like the biggest change, isn't it?
Well, I actually think that the surge of female comedians, if you could call it that, is down to people actually opening their eyes. Because... I've loved female comics all my comedy career, all the time that
I've
loved comedy.
Some of my best friends.
Yes, but like it's like the industry didn't know they existed. The broadcasters, and similarly, Instagram, let people see what they liked. They will feed you what you like.
Listen, we might end up talking about the work too much.
Yeah.
Tell us about the things you need to plug, because you are touring nonstop all the time in between the podcasts. So many things. What do you want to plug? Because you've got so many things.
I am. I guess I'll be in the INEC Arena in Killarney on July 5th.
Very good. Down there in the Glen Eagles, July 5th. Yeah, you can book yourself a weekend. Waterford Theatre Royal. That's a lovely theatre.
Love that theatre, yeah. 22nd of June there.
Midsummer. Armagh Marketplace Theatre.
Oh, that's a wonderful theatre.
Oh, that's this month, 25th of May.
25th of May.
And the Olympia Theatre on the 30th of May. That's what it's called. Yeah. Jigsaw.com/gigs for all of Jarlath Regan's dates.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. May the force be with you at Mass when the priest would say, peace be with you, say, may the force be with you, says Paul Little in Wexford. So go with that message.
And also
Jarlath
with
Regan.
You, Paul.
So there you go. Marion Keyes's Feathery Strokers, Fiona Neary's Parcels in the Post, and Jarlath Regan's Dermot Bannon Star Wars Multiverse. It is the end of the podcast as you know it. Go in peace to love and serve yourself an Ulster final on Sunday. I'll be back on the radio next week. If you have interesting stories, things you think we need to know, pop an email anytime. Don't be afraid to do it. oliver@rte.ie. That's everything. Slán agus podcast amach.
0818 715 925. Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1.